listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers recorded on the land of the Wurundjeri people.
Hi, I'm Robin Whittaker.
And I'm Monica Melanchthon.
And we're here in Pentecost 9, or Ordinary Week 19, and today we're going to be discussing Psalm 50, verses 1 to 8, 22 to 23, Isaiah chapter 1, 1, and then 10 to 20, Hebrews 11, 1 to 3, and 8 to 16, lots of choppy readings, and Luke 12, 32 to 40. So, Monica, let's start with the psalm. What might we notice and what themes emerge from Psalm 50?
So Psalm 50, which is also called the Song of Asaph, okay, mm-hmm. introduces the coming of God on earth for a time of judgment. Maybe the psalm was something that was used during a religious ceremony. Mm-hmm. And in this psalm, God is summoning all people from both the heavens and the earth, from the east and the west, to come and hear him, or to hear God, And so you have both the vertical dimensions, that is the heavens and the earth, and also the east and the west is the horizontal dimensions. So people...
The whole cosmos, really.
Yes. And they are all called or invited to witness an act of judgment. Now, what struck for me here is the fact that the arrival of the judge in any courtroom is always always quite dramatic. You know, when you watch the shows on TV, all rise says
yes. You there's know, a formality. Yep.
Yeah, and so similarly here, you have the coming of the judge, as you said, described in cosmic terms, and this coming is accompanied by a consuming fire and a very and a storm, and through this storm. Or tempest comes the voice of God saying, gather to me my faithful ones who made a covenant with me by sacrifice. And so here the scene is therefore set for the judge to speak, and God the judge speaks in verses 7 to 15, announcing a case against Israel. So basically what is being said is something is wrong, and something that is happening is at this place of worship is not right. Yes, sacrifices are being offered at a timely, in a timely and proper manner, but still something is wrong, and that something has to do with what is outside the place of worship.
Yes.
Okay. Yep. There seems to be, the community seems to have made a separation between life in the sanctuary or worship in the sanctuary and their life outside of the sanctuary. So they have divided it into two separate compartments. And so these verses in many ways echo the words, the critique of prophecies, particularly Isaiah, as we're going to read today, and Amos and Jeremiah. And so the psalm is basically saying that religion or faith or worship is not only lip deep, as one scholar has referred to it, but also it's not just a matter of words, but also works.
Yes.
Okay. So a warning is therefore issued in verse 22. The people are accused of forgetting God, and therefore they are being invited to get their lives in order. So what God is really wanting here through the psalm is to walk the talk, or put your money where your mouth is, you know, or, yes, make sacrifices, give thanks, but also go the right way, right way.
And I think that also in what you said is so important, because this theme's going to run across a couple of our readings today, and it's not a critique of sacrifices. We're going to see this in Isaiah per se. Mm. It's not that sacrifices are bad. It's that sacrifices without action and love and kindness and compassion
and justice,
a key word, are not enough. And
So basically it's a call to talk the talk of religion and also to walk the walk.
Yeah,
of religion.
That your rituals are not enough.
They have to be accompanied by action. And I remember here a blessing that that I have heard used in some churches, where you know the time of worshiping you has ended. Now we go out in order to continue to worship you, but through service.
Yes, you know that we carry out.
Yeah,
and some churches do that ritually with the. I used to go to a church that where they carried out the Bible mm-hmm. and a candle with it, and the whole point was the word of God and the light of God now goes out with us into the community mm-hmm. and we continue this work.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, there's various.
And so the psalm is a very good reminder of what our faith is all about. That it is not confined to the Sunday worship services, but it is something that has to be lived out, acted upon during the rest of the week.
Yep. Well, that's a nice segue perhaps to Isaiah, where we also get images of judgment.
Yes. This is a very, interesting and powerful opening to a book.
The book of
Isaiah. And for many scholars see this particular chapter as an introduction to the book. And it is a rich chapter that does not stand alone because it opens the entire book, but it also provides an overture to the entire book, enunciating the themes that the prophet is going to be addressing in the first 39 chapters of the book.
And Monica, can we give this a little historic context? Am I right in thinking, given that you're the Hebrew Bible scholar, this is maybe 8th century, we've got the threat of Assyria, the doorstep of Jerusalem and Judah.
Sure. Verse 1 gives you some clues as to the time period in which the prophet was prophesying. But basically the background is, the time when Judah was an independent country, but Judah was being invited to join Israel in the north and Syria in a coalition to fight against the Assyrians. But Judah hesitates, and so Syria and Israel join forces to attack Judah, and Judah loses some of its. So the Syro-Ephraimite War, as it's called, is in the background. Yep. But now Judah has also become beholden to Assyria.
Yes,
you see.
Yep.
So therefore, while it was a time of prosperity, it was also a time of vulnerability to external forces, namely Assyria at this particular point. Yeah.
So pressure and crisis and real threat. And I do wonder sometimes then if these prophets frame that around divine action and, the threat of judgment. I mean, we end our passage in the lectionary today with this threat of if there isn't repentance and change, the sword will devour, and how much that sword would have been heard of, the sword of the Assyrian army.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very real threat. We're not just talking metaphor necessarily.
No. It's a real threat politically. Yep. And what the prophet is calling attention to is the fact that the people of Judah and its leadership were looking to forge political alliances in order to confront this threat or to deal with this threat, and they're also following rituals that were not in line or in sync with Yahvism as their faith, and they were not really looking to Yahweh to find solutions. They're trying to look for solutions elsewhere. Everywhere else except through their faith in Yahweh.
Yes.
So so therefore the chapter as a whole is calling on the people to recognize. It begins with recognize what you're doing. These political alliances, this idolatry, that is worship of Baal, and the social structures that you have in place are not in sync with what God requires of you.
So again, we've got reference, a bit like the psalm, to, although stronger here, I think, I'm sated, I'm reading the, Robert Alter translation, I'm sated with your burnt offerings of rams and the suet of fatted beasts, the blood of bulls. There's a sense that God says, I'm turning my face from this.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, it's not accompanied by care for the orphan, the widow, the oppressed, we get to in verse 17. There's again seems to be this complete disconnect between the ritual offerings and any sense of justice in the wider community.
Right, right. So actually in these verses, you have a listing of all the things that make God unhappy.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So you have, claims such as, the sacrifices, speeches, and the legitimacy of pilgrimages to the temple, communal celebrations, God is criticizing the value of individual prayers. And so all this critique, in verses 10 to 15, and the critique is followed by a call upon the people to purify their lives. So verses 16 and 17 are actually quite significant and crucial for our understanding of this text. And so in verses 16 and 17, you have a series of imperatives, six of them, if I count them right, giving clues to the people as to what they should do in order to rectify and their relationship with God.
Reconciled, avoid judgment. Yeah. Yes. Yep.
And so here you say, much of the terminology that is used is cultic. Okay.
Yes, wash, it is.
Clean,
wash,
purify. Yep. These are cultic terms, but the cultic terms are juxtaposed with care for the widow and the orphan in verse 17. So there is a linking or an integration that is being suggested here of both cultic ritual and social justice.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. They go back together.
Yeah.
I wondered too whether there was an economic kind of play hovering. There's a tension between, not all sacrifices were expensive, but a fatted, to fatten up a sheep or something, a flock, is an expensive sacrifice, these whole burnt offerings. And so there's something about money being spent again in a sort of the performance of ritual piety when it's not accompanied by...
Yeah.
Care for the orphan and the widow, the vulnerable, who are economically incredibly vulnerable in that day and age, as they often are today. Yeah. So there is a real practical thread that binds these things together, as you're saying.
Yeah. So basically, what the Isaiah passage is calling for is an integration of these two: your worship life and your care for the oppressed, the widow and the orphan. It has been pointed out as to why Isaiah has not included the alien.
Yes, usually the stranger. Yes.
Yeah. The three are
usually clustered.
Appear together.
The widow, the orphan and the alien in the land. Yep.
Yeah, and so maybe it was not within the purview of his context at that particular time. But in any case, that has been pointed out. So there's the cultic orientation that is being called for here, through the washing and the purifying and the cleaning, has to be accompanied by social justice, as I have already said. And so there is a balance between worship life and your outward expression of this religious life, as mentioned in Psalm, Psalm 50
as well.
Yeah. Yep. So there is the vertical dimension here once again through the cult, and the horizontal dimension in terms of how you care for the needy and the oppressed within the community. And I think if there is an imbalance, then something the relationship is not perfect.
And the judgment is harsh. I mean, this idea that God, I was really struck by, intimacy in the Older Testament is often framed as seeing God's face, the sense of wanting to see God is a way of being close to God. And Moses, that great prophet, spoke to God face to face in the tradition. And in verse 12, there is language about coming before God, literally to see God's face. And then God in verse 15, hiding God's eyes, like refusing to look and refusing to hear the prayers. So I guess it's another way into what you were just saying, I think, Monica, which is there is a sense that if you're not doing the care for neighbor, that horizontal move, the divine relationship gets shattered. And in fact, the thing that really struck me here is there's almost a sense of God saying, I will remove myself. I will not listen because you haven't done this other work. I'm out of the temple. I'm out of the church, kind of thing.
And I think it's also important to recognize that while the vertical and the horizontal are also interconnected in the sense, how do we express our love and our faith and our devotion to God if not through Okay, because God is, well,
exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, you know, yeah. I can't put words to it, but the way in which you live out your love for God is through love for the neighbor, yeah. You know, and here basically, you know, the orphan and the widow encapsulate the oppressed as being the least of the oppressed in the community. Yeah.
If you'd like to know more about By the Well or any of our hosts, please visit bythewell.com.au.
So shall we turn to the New Testament? Hebrews chapter 11, 1 to 3, 8 to 16 is this famous passage. If people know anything about from the letter to the Hebrews, it might be this. Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. And then we're going to get this looking back, which this author does a number of times, this constant linking to the tradition and the way God has spoken through the prophets and through the ancestors and what God, you know, that God's action in Jesus is in complete continuity with this tradition. Again, we've got a bit of a context here of there's clearly a sense of threat in this community. If we look at the previous chapter, threat of death, the crisis, costliness to following. So in some ways I think this is faith or belief is about addressing or words of assurance in the midst of, again, uncertain times.
Yeah. I mean, the text for today focuses on Abraham.
Yes.
Just one amongst the many examples that the chapter actually calls attention to. And I think the author was quite, particular in mentioning ancestors whom the community is familiar with.
Yes.
Okay. And so, but all of them have been listed as ones who have expressed their, have lived out their faith in the context of some danger or crisis. And have not let go of their faith in Yahweh. So here Abraham is uplifted in our text for today, as a person of faith, who was instructed to go into a land unknown, uncertainty, vulnerability, migrants will completely resonate with what is of Abraham's experience,
yeah.
And so here there is encouragement being given to an audience that is fearing for their lives, and in that context they are being encouraged to hold on to their faith in God.
Yeah, that's right. And this word faith, pistis, I wonder if it might disrupt the way people hear this to translate it belief. I mean, that pistis can mean faith, belief, trust. And you know, there's really strong language that opens this, you know, that the belief is the absolute sort of the confidence of what we hope for. And the hypostasis word here used for the confidence or foundation is literally that something that sits underneath is used of Jesus himself in chapter one, that Jesus is the kind of the foundation of God's image or the reflection. There's a surety to it that often we think beliefs are just, you know, particularly in Australian culture, I think, nonsense things you just made up. You believe in this invisible being or something, but here it's got a concrete life, and Abraham is one way it gets, brought into a very pragmatic realm that this is what he did. He went to a land before he could see it. Mm. You know, he trusted he would have children before he could see them despite all odds, you know, this kind of... And I wonder if church communities might want to tell, it's an opportunity to reflect on your own faith ancestors in tradition.
Yes, yes. And it's also clear that in this through this chapter, the author is linking faith with crisis, faith and death, and these examples, including that of Abraham, are praised for their faithful endurance despite fear, despite death.
Yes.
And I think there is a message for us in today,
yep.
In the sense that we are we are in the midst of a crisis, not just in terms of COVID and, you know, climate change and global warming. All of these are fearful and serious. But I think within the UCA, we talk about it, a dying church.
Yep. You know. And I think that's true for a lot of mainstream more liberal denominations, that we're declining.
Yeah,
I've just been in the UK and having similar conversations there with people in the Reformed tradition, people in the Church of England tradition about, you know, a sense of decline and hard conversations about buildings closing. And of course, buildings are not the church.
Yeah.
But yeah, it struck me that to tell our stories, the looking back, it's a chance to do looking back, but then the text also points us forward. It uses language of promise. Abraham's described as this sojourner, you know, this journeying, and this is a theme in Hebrews, that we as Christians tread lightly on this earth because it's not our true home. And in a sense, this author, and we don't really know who this author is, spiritualizes the Abraham tradition a bit. So Abraham looked for this promised land, but in the Christian tradition, then this promised land becomes a heavenly place that God's prepared. And that way we tread lightly on this earth because, and I don't mean tread lightly in a sense of therefore we do nothing about climate change, which is what some Christians do, but we tread lightly in that we know we have a true spiritual home that's elsewhere. And yeah, it just struck me that some of that looking forward, and I say that because, you know, again, if we think of our local context and decline in a large part of the Western church, we can interpret it as our actions have come to nothing. But actually the destination might just look a bit different to what we expected it to look like. And that's part of the journey of faith too.
Yes.
That there is a destination, it's just that it might look different to what our ancestors thought.
Yes.
Even if that's 10 years ago. You know?
Right, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Should we move on to the gospel?
Sure. Sure.
So Luke 12:32-40. Monica, what do you want to focus on here? We've almost got two readings in one, haven't we? It's a funny.
This passage, I mean, I looked at it in preparation for this morning, and I think one thing that really, struck for me is the fact that all discussions around issues of slavery are significant and troubling, and troubling as well, particularly as someone who comes from a very hierarchically structured society where there's a distinction between the haves and the have-nots, between the master and the slaves. Yeah. And so here you have a text that is using an example of a master-slave relationship, and it is an example that doesn't need a lot of explanation because most people, at least at that particular time, could fully understand.
Very familiar,
what Luke is saying here. And the typical conduct of a master-slave relationship is one in which the slave serves the master. But here, the text is also saying that the master would expect the slave to serve him or her. But here you have where the master, returns and notices what the slave has done, and there's an inversion of roles. The landlord of the house or the master here then serves the servant or serves the slave. Another thing that struck for me here with regard to this inversion of roles is the fact that Luke is using the metaphor of a thief, which is a deviant social profession.
Yes.
If you want to call it a profession, it's an institution of crime. And breaking into a house is institutionally of that institution is typical.
Yes.
You know, of thief behavior. Of thievery, yeah.
And unwelcome. And nobody wants a thief.
Yeah, it's socially unacceptable conduct. And so here, the Son of God will come like a thief. The focus of the utterance here is on the unexpectedness of this socially unacceptable conduct. You know,
yes.
So the coming of the Son of Man is likened to the coming of the thief.
Yep.
you know, both in its unexpectedness and also in its negative connotation.
Yes, that they could threaten.
Yeah, I think which, I don't know how many of us have actually thought of that, you know.
Yeah, yes. Yes.
Using a negative connotation to describe the divine.
Yeah, that's right.
A negative metaphor.
For me, the metaphor brings in a sense of that threat and fear. I think we can read this and go, oh, that's lovely, but actually the work it's doing is a thief that comes at some unknown hour in the night potentially is supposed to be a fearful image. Mm-hmm. And there's a sense of if you're not ready, then the arrival of the Son of Man, also – perhaps comes with some consequences.
Yes, that links with the Isaiah passage as well. In other words, you know, God is here. God is going to judge.
Mm.
And, excuse me. Sorry. And you have to be prepared. You have to wash yourself, make yourself clean, and be ready. Yeah.
Get ready for the divine. I think it helps here, while you have a sip of water, poor Monica's coughing, it helps here to also, you know, take our focus out a bit wider. This passage starts with "Do not be afraid." A few verses before this, we've had "Do not worry." Do not worry about where your food comes from. So we've got a thread running throughout of, concern for possessions, and of course this language of where your treasure is, so storing up treasure. And if we go back just a touch further too, we have the parable earlier in chapter 12. It's often labeled the parable of the rich fool, but the man who stores up, you know, crops and crops and wealth in his barn and, you know, says, great, I can relax now, and of course that night dies. So we've got these stories of storing up treasure and anxiety around possession and controlling our environment, and then the threat of, but God could come at any point and you've prepared all the wrong things, which maybe takes us, I think there is a link here with Isaiah and again concern for dispossessing yourself of possessions in the early part of this passage, verse 33, giving alms, and again this treasure language, which I think is about money. Luke is concerned about wealth ethics, very much so. But in a contemporary context, and depending on the context you're preaching in, I can't think about – treasure is also where we spend our time. And if our time is spent on, you know, getting as many Instagram likes as possible, or, you know, there's all sorts of distractions and things in the modern world that we spend our time on. And so there's an opportunity here maybe to do some reflection around – you know, where, what our values are, and does our behavior match our values? Mm-hmm. Because if we say we follow Christ, that sort of loops us all the way back to Isaiah, really. Mm-hmm. If we come to worship, if we're in church because we love God, mm-hmm. are our behaviors and our financial ethics and our concern for the marginalized matching up to what we say with our mouths?
Yeah. And one other thing that I noticed in this particular text is the fact that while the structural relations are inverted, the master does not become a slave.
No.
Okay. Nor does the slave become the master. You know. So the manager remains the manager, and the common servant remains the common. The distinctiveness of their behavior lies in their willingness to act atypically.
Yes, and to
namely to serve. And so service here from a position of hierarchy or from a position in power, is what is being emphasized here.
Yes, I read one commentator who talked about, along with this selling your possessions, the dispossession of possessions, part of what goes on in this passage is then the dispossession of your power.
Great.
In the willingness to serve and take on the role of another alongside them. So this isn't charity out of our excess.
No.
This is a sitting alongside in a way that we do give up something.
Yeah. And, you know, you pointed to the parable that was, that precedes this particular section. And even there, too, the man amassed wealth, thinking, but he was amassing wealth for himself.
Yes.
And not for the, and so there is no mention there of the kinds of strategies he employed in order to amass the wealth.
No.
But he, okay.
Or the ethics of it.
Yeah. But basically, that passage, I think, is critiquing the selfishness of the individual.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
And it is almost a creating a kingdom for yourself. I was really struck because I've just never noticed it before. The very first line here about, you know, do not be afraid. It's your father's good pleasure. It's your father's well wish, you know, in the Greek, to give you the kingdom. The kingdom of God is a gift. And if we think of that as a gift, it's a gift to be shared, not to be stored up for ourselves.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia. It's produced by Adrian Jackson. Thanks for listening.